That's why the jhanas are so useful in the adept stages. Once some joy and happiness are present, absorption intensifies the joy and happiness, and a temporary but very strong unification results. When we repeat this often enough, our mind becomes habituated to unification. You may have experienced some mild, brief episodes of meditative joy in stages 4 through 7. You will have experienced longer, more intense episodes if you did the whole body and pleasure jhana practices in stages 6 and 7. However, the joy of grades 4 and 5 piti in stage 8 is something you've likely never experienced before. Energy currents and involuntary movements. Before achieving fully developed meditative joy, you'll encounter various energy currents, involuntary movements, and autonomic activity, all of which can be quite uncomfortable. Eventually, the movements and autonomic reactions will stop, the energy currents will be pleasant, and you'll experience the meditative joy of grade 5 piti. But until then, the flow of newly available energy due to increasing unification is quite turbulent. In the ordinary, untrained, and ununified mind, much of the energy generated by individual sub-minds gets used up in inner conflicts, many of them unconscious. As an analogy, picture a group of horses, all tethered together, but with each one trying to move in a different direction. Any movement of the group as a whole will be slow. The direction and speed of movement will depend on the strongest horses, and whenever several horses happen, by chance, to start pulling in the same direction. Abrupt changes in direction will also happen frequently and unpredictably. The behavior of the untrained mind is much the same. Attention wavers and scatters, constantly vulnerable to being captured by new sensory or mental objects. Unrelated thoughts come up. Many different kinds of emotions, including restlessness, doubt, and boredom, arise out of the unconscious mind, each claiming justification and demanding to be responded to. When the mind begins to unify, it's like more of the horses are heading in the same direction at the same time, so the speed and momentum of the group as a whole, that is, the net kinetic energy, increases. The course becomes more consistent, but the movement isn't smooth. In fact, because some animals still resist while others may stumble and be dragged along by the group, it's more violent and erratic than ever. And as long as some keep resisting and try to go in different directions, the turbulence will continue. The available mental energy increases, but until unification is complete, the flow of that energy is turbulent. Turbulent mental energy manifests in various ways. The feeling of energy currents coursing through the body can be tumultuous or even painful, though they can also be mild and pleasant. These energy currents, as well as the involuntary movements and autonomic reactions that often accompany them, were described in detail in the sixth interlude. These currents are the same chi, prana, or inner wind that you experienced in the body scanning and whole body breath practices of stages 5 and 6. As the mind progressively unifies in stage 8, this energy intensifies. But as long as unification is incomplete, the turbulence intensifies as well. By the end of stage 8, you can consistently unify your mind enough for sustained meditative joy to arise, along with the blisses of physical and mental pliancy. Involuntary movements stop, and the flow of energy feels much smoother and more pleasant. However, the meditative joy may be so intense that it becomes enormously distracting. In fact, meditators will sometimes end their meditation early, just so they can go talk to someone about it. To conclude with our analogy, when all the tethered horses pull in the same direction, they form a powerful team that moves smoothly and is easily controlled. So too, a unified mind displays a smooth, controlled power in the movement of mental energy, and turbulence completely disappears. But not until the end of stage 9 will unification be complete enough for that to happen. Until then, you can expect your meditation to be dominated by experiences of excess, uncontrolled energy. Practices to help achieve physical pliancy and meditative joy. At some point, you'll experience the manifestations of physical pliancy, such as the absence of ordinary tactile sensations, feelings of weightlessness or floating, and pleasurable sensations throughout the body, grade 4 PT. When this happens, it's time to temporarily abandon the practices described in the section on exercising the newly compliant mind. You're in the home stretch for this stage. Now the most important thing is to completely ignore bodily sensations of any kind. Here are two practices that can help. Finding the still point and realizing the witness. This practice allows us to step outside our reactions to the sensory experiences associated with pacification and the arising of piti. This creates enough detachment to let these processes unfold naturally by themselves. Piti sensations still appear in awareness, but receive no attention at all. Start your meditation by becoming fully aware of the world around you. Explore your immediate environs with attention. Feel it in your body. Listen to the sounds inside and outside the room you're sitting in. Sense all of the activity that's going on. For example, you might hear airplanes flying overhead, traffic noises, birds and dogs, and various human activities. Then let your mind identify and fill in the source of the sounds you hear. Picture in your mind the cars you hear, the airplanes flying through the sky, and the birds sitting in trees. Expand the scope of your attention to include a visualization of the constant ferment of activity going on all over the world, on land, in the waters, and in the sky. Reflect on the earth as it spins on its axis, moving through space at thousands of miles per hour, surrounded by the constant motion of planets and stars and entire galaxies whirling through the void at inconceivable speeds. While keeping this universe of ceaseless movement and change clear in your awareness, shift your attention to your body, sitting in stillness on the cushion. Allow the contrast between the stillness of your body and the activity of the external world to saturate your consciousness. Keep your attention focused on your body while the rest of the world fills your awareness. Over time, you'll naturally become aware of movement and activity in the body, breathing, the beating of your heart, and pulsing in your arteries, and maybe the energy currents and involuntary movements of piti. Visualize all the other activity you know is taking place in your body, the movement of food through your digestive tract, the flow of blood through tissue, urine collecting in the bladder, and glands secreting substances of all kinds. Once you have a clear, strong sense of your body as a hive of activity, shift the focus of your attention to your mind. Let the hum of activity in your body join the rest of the world in peripheral awareness while attending to the relative peace and quiet of your well-trained mind. Contrast the relative calm and quiet of the mind with all the turmoil, activity, and change in the realm of physical sensations, noting in particular that quality of mental stillness and peace. Allow your attention to dwell on the difference between your mind's inner stillness and the teeming activity in your body and the world. Inevitably, you start to notice that the mind really isn't that quiet after all, except when compared to everything outside of it. At the same time, you'll become aware of an even greater stillness at the core of your moment-to-moment experience. This is called the still point. Find that still point and make its stillness the focus of your attention. Relegate everything else to peripheral awareness, letting things remain or pass away as they will. Enjoy the still point, resting in it as often and for as long as you like. The strange sensations of pacification and the energies of piti will just blend in with everything else in the background of awareness while attention rests unperturbed. Unification will continue. By doing this practice and investigating the still point, it becomes obvious that this is where all observation happens. The still point, in other words, is the metaphorical vantage point from which metacognitive awareness occurs, except that it's now become the seat of metacognitive attention. And the focus of your attention is the subjective experience of looking at the mind and the material world from a totally detached perspective. As you keep observing, you may also discover the so-called witness, the subjective experience of a pure, unmoving, and unmoved observer who is unaffected by whatever is observed. A warning is in order here. You will likely feel that you have discovered the true self, the ultimate ground of all experience. In a sense, you have, but it's not at all what you think. The witness state is the ultimate ground of your personal experience, but it has arisen in dependence upon the body and the world, and it will disappear with the body. Its real value and significance is that it points toward a much more profound insight, provided you don't make the mistake of clinging to it as a self. Doing so only nourishes the attachment we are all born with to the idea of being a singular, enduring, and separate self. Mistaking the witness state for a true self is what leads some people to claim that consciousness is the true self. To properly use the witness experience, probe more deeply. Go to the still point, the place of the witness, with a question. Who or what is this witness? Who is watching? Who is experiencing? Adamantly refuse to entertain any answers offered by your intellectual, thinking mind. Also, don't be deceived by your emotional mind, which will try to make you believe you've found the answer when you haven't. Just hold on to the question as you experience the witness. If and when insight arises, it will be a profound insight into the truth of no self, and it will be so obvious that you'll wonder why you never realized it before. Don't judge yourself or your practice by whether or not you discover the witness, or whether or not you have insight into no self. These will happen in time. Meanwhile, the still point meditation is a powerful method for achieving the goals of this stage: unification, pacification of the senses, and meditative joy. The luminous jhanas. These are deeper than the whole body or pleasure jhanas and are called luminous because the object of meditation used for entering the first jhana is the illumination phenomenon. This inner light is often called animitta, and the sensations of the breath are abandoned in favor of this luminous nimitta. Because it is mind-generated rather than being a true sensory object, it allows all sensory content to be completely excluded from consciousness. Not everyone experiences the inner illumination phenomenon, so not everyone can practice these jhanas. If you're one of these people, don't worry. Jhana practice isn't essential to mastering stage 8. Also, even deeper jhanas will become available once you've mastered the later stages. The nimitta may begin as a soft, fuzzy, or misty illumination, as a glowing disk or sphere, or as star-like, flickering pinpoints of light. If the nimitta is dim at first, it will gradually brighten. The pinpoints will expand, and multiple sparkles will coalesce. Colored lights tend to pale toward white, and the nimitta becomes more radiant, bright, and clear. When it appears, resist the temptation to chase the nimitta. It will usually disappear if you direct attention toward it too soon. To cultivate the nimitta, keep your attention focused on the breath sensations while allowing the illumination to grow and brighten in peripheral awareness. At the same time, don't completely disregard it. Be as fully aware of it as you can without diverting attention toward it. Sometimes it won't appear at all. Just remain patient. Eventually, it will be there all the time. Also, don't try to will it to grow or intensify. That actually prevents the nimitta from developing naturally, making it fade away. The nimitta must develop on its own. As it intensifies, the sensations associated with pacification of the senses fade from peripheral awareness. Sustained subtle dullness can sometimes creep in as you allow the nimitta to develop in the background, so be careful that doesn't happen. Otherwise, you can get stuck and your undeveloped nimitta just won't go anywhere. As you'll soon discover, attention occasionally alternates with the nimitta in peripheral awareness. That's all right, because alternating attention lets you know when the nimitta has become stable enough to accept attention. Eventually, you will notice that when your attention shifts to the nimitta, it no longer fades. Once that happens, you can intentionally allow attention to alternate between the nimitta and the breath. Attention will naturally be drawn to the nimitta, spending more and more time with it. At some point, the breath and the nimitta will both be receiving the same amount of attention, and the two will seem to merge. When this happens, start working with the nimitta. First, intentionally let it recede into the background, appearing small and distant. Then, bring it in close so that it completely fills your visual field. Next, try shifting the bright center of the nimitta up or down, or from side to side. When the nimitta is stable enough that you can control it like this, you're ready to completely abandon the physical sensations of the breath and attend exclusively to the nimitta. Not everyone will succeed in moving the nimitta, but it doesn't matter. As long as your efforts don't cause it to fade, it's stable enough to use for entering jhana. Entering first luminous jhana. Once the nimitta is stable enough to become the object of exclusive attention, you're ready to enter the first luminous jhana. Absorbing into this nimitta is not something you do. It's a surrendering that draws the mind into the experience of the moment. Open up to it totally, becoming a completely passive observer. The mind is relaxed but alert, and attention and awareness are sharp and clear. Entering this kind of deep jhana has been compared to submerging yourself in a warm bath. The bliss of physical pliancy floods the body with pleasure, pervading and saturating it everywhere. Meditative joy intensifies as well, and feelings of happiness grow as the bliss of mental pliancy increases. Energy intensifies as the mind fills with joy and happiness. You still feel energy sensations in your body, but they are no longer disturbing or unpleasant. Spontaneous physical movements cease, replaced by a profound stillness. Attention fuses with its object, and awareness takes on an open, spacious quality. The perception of the nimitta in the first jhana is sharper, clearer, and more intense than ever. At first, there may be some subtle unsteadiness in terms of the contents of awareness. Certain objects may intrude. For example, there may be some awareness of actual physical sensations or of mind-generated bodily sensations due to pacification. But as you stay focused exclusively on the nimitta, these fade, and you're soon fully absorbed in jhana. If you've previously practiced the whole body or pleasure jhanas, you will immediately recognize when you've slipped into the familiar groove. But if you've never experienced jhana before, you may wonder how you will know when you've reached jhana. After all, the jhana factors are all present with access concentration. And if you were to describe the state of your mind in access, it would sound exactly like the classical descriptions of jhana. Just persevere. When you do finally enter jhana, you will no longer have any doubts about it. And best of all, the mind will know how to find its way back to this state again in the future. The jhana may not last long to begin with, especially if this is your first time experiencing jhana. But when you pop out, just go back in. Keep returning to jhana until you can stay in for longer, working up to 10 minutes, then half an hour, and eventually an hour or more. When you emerge, you will have a sudden experience of intense sensory awareness. Your mind is highly sensitized to every kind of sensory input. That's why we describe it as popping out. The deeper the jhana and the longer you've been in, the more intense the emergence. Practice entering the jhana at will, sustaining it for a predetermined period, and emerging at the intended time. To do this, you must generate a strong intention while in access concentration. People often find it useful to mentally verbalize these intentions. I resolve to enter first jhana and remain for X minutes. Remember, you cannot make these things happen yourself, because no doing or deciding happens in jhana. But holding a conscious intention prior to entering the jhana will cause them to happen. When you can stay longer in jhana, you will discover there is a timeless quality to it, meaning you have no awareness of how much or little time has passed. To practice remaining in jhana for predetermined periods, you will need to position an easy-to-read clock in front of yourself. Give it a quick glance before entering access, and again on emerging from the jhana. Once you emerge from jhana, review your experience. Compare and contrast the access, jhana, and post-jhanic states. When you emerge from jhana, there will be a very strong imprint of the jhanic state in memory. Compare that recollection with the post-jhanic state you're in. It's like putting two transparencies together and holding them up to the light. You can easily see what is different and what is the same. Do the same with your memory of the pre-jhanic access state. Then compare the jhana and pre-jhanic access states to each other. Notice the similarities and differences between each of these three states, what is present and absent, and the subjective qualities associated with each. The first jhana is characterized by profound calmness, a clear, sharp perception of the nimitta as the object of attention, vitaka and vichara, and awareness of joy, pleasure, and happiness, piti sukha. The mind is, of course, in a highly unified state, ekagata. As you get more familiar with the jhana, though, you will realize that the intensity of first jhana often fluctuates. This instability is typical of first jhana. Sometimes you may even be aware of a thought or intention arising in the mind. Whenever this happens, it's because you have very briefly emerged, then immediately re-entered jhana, like a swimming dolphin that barely breaks the surface before diving again. Another first jhana quality you will become aware of over time is a subtle energetic vibration, often felt in the body. Eventually, you will grow increasingly dissatisfied with how the jhana fluctuates in intensity. This indicates you're ready for second jhana. But don't rush it. Getting stuck. You can get stuck at any point during the process of pacification of the senses and the arising of meditative joy. You'll know because you'll constantly have disruptive and often unpleasant experiences in meditation, with little or no sign of change or improvement. Say, for example, that every time after you sit down and achieve effortlessness, you always experience abrupt, violent, jerking movements, or an unpleasant tingling, itchiness, and hot flashes that just get more disagreeable over time. Or you experience intensely unpleasant energy sensations and severe pain in your chest or neck, or constantly feel like you're falling over. Maybe you often get dizzy, sweat, or feel nauseated. While a certain amount of this is normal, when it happens consistently and doesn't improve, something is blocking your progress. As we explained in the sixth interlude, it may be the hindrances of aversion and agitation due to worry and remorse. To the degree these hindrances are present, even at a subconscious level, they prevent unification of the mind and normal progress through the grades of piti. The antidote to aversion is deliberately cultivating love, compassion, patience, generosity, and forgiveness toward everyone, including yourself. The antidote to worry and remorse is practicing virtue in every aspect of your life. You can change bad habits and stop doing things that create the causes of worry and remorse. Make amends for things you've already done or failed to do. And if you can't do it directly, do it through acts of kindness and service to those who suffer in the ways you've made others suffer. Seek others' forgiveness, and especially, forgive yourself. In other words, if you find yourself getting stuck in stage 8, the answer lies outside meditation, in how you live the rest of your life. Adept practice depends on everything you do, all day long, every day. There is actually an advantage to working through stage 8 in daily practice rather than in deep retreat. You have more opportunities to take the appropriate actions to overcome these hindrances. Thus, Ananda, the purpose and benefit of virtuous behavior is freedom from remorse. The purpose and benefit of freedom from remorse is satisfaction. The purpose and benefit of satisfaction is joy, piti. The purpose and benefit of joy is pacification of the body. The purpose and benefit of pacification of the body is pleasure, sukha. The purpose and benefit of pleasure is concentration, samadhi. The purpose and benefit of concentration is knowledge and vision of things as they really are. The purpose and benefit of knowledge and vision of things as they really are is disenchantment and dispassion. The purpose and benefit of disenchantment and dispassion is knowledge and vision of liberation. Kamatiya Sutta, Purpose and Benefits of Virtue, from the Anguttara Nikaya, 10.1.1.1. Conclusion. You've mastered stage 8 when you achieve physical pliancy and meditative joy almost every time you sit. Experiencing periods of grade 5 piti once or twice, or even every third or fourth time you sit, is not yet true mastery. Consistency is key. Ordinary sensations have disappeared from awareness. The perception of your body may have changed, feeling light and pleasant, and you have no need or desire to move. The illumination phenomenon, if present, has become an all-pervading light or bright, stable orb. The inner sound is either pleasant or just a meaningless, unobtrusive background noise. You still feel energy flowing through the body, circulating between the base of the spine and the crown of the head, and between the body core and periphery, but it's much smoother and more pleasant. The intensity of joy and feelings of energy may grow so strong that they can't be sustained, or they may make you want to end your meditation early. That's normal. Becoming familiar with meditative joy so this doesn't happen is the work of stage 9. Stage 9. Mental and physical pliancy and calming the intensity of meditative joy. 9. The goal of stage 9 is the maturation of meditative joy that produces tranquility and equanimity. As you continue to practice, simply abiding in the state of meditative joy will cause profound tranquility and equanimity to arise. In stages 9 and 10, you fully unify the mind, moving from a state of highly excited meditative joy and happiness to one of serene joy and happiness. The resulting shamatha has 5 qualities of mind: fully stable attention, powerful mindfulness, joy, tranquility, and equanimity. Although meditation experiences in these final stages are quite consistent from one person to the next, they are often described in very different ways, partly because it's hard to put such rare, subtle experiences into familiar terms. The other reason is that people explain their experiences according to the diverse conceptual models provided by the particular traditions they follow. However, as your practice progresses, you'll start recognizing the common experiences these various descriptions all point toward. Here we give a general description, using only the conceptual models we've introduced in this book, while avoiding the unique particulars belonging to specific traditions. Practice goals for stage 9. You've reached stage 9 when there's complete pacification of the senses, and fully developed meditative joy. This means that almost every time you sit, you can enter a state of mental and physical pliancy, accompanied by the blisses of mental and physical pliancy. This is also called grade 5, or pervading piti, which you experience as circulating energy, physical comfort, pleasure, stability, and intense joy. Although you can regularly achieve this grade of piti, each time you do, the growing intensity of the joy and energy of the experience inevitably disrupts it. The goal of stage 9 is for meditative joy to mature completely, and for piti to subside in intensity. You accomplish this by repeatedly reaching grade 5 piti and sustaining it for as long as you can. Other than that, you just have to stay out of the way while continuing to practice. When you can stay with the piti long enough, allowing unification to proceed and joy to mature, piti eventually gives way to tranquility and equanimity. This is the essence of stage 9 practice. Piti as an inclusive term. We use piti in these final stages as an inclusive term that captures a lot of complexity in a succinct way. It will be helpful to remember everything this umbrella term includes: full pacification of the senses, along with physical pliancy and the bliss of physical pliancy, and meditative joy, along with mental pliancy and the bliss of mental pliancy. Calming piti and maturing joy. For the intensity of piti to calm, you need to be able to sustain it until the intensity peaks and starts to subside, giving way to tranquility and equanimity. At first, grade 5 piti can't be sustained very long at all, because physical pliancy is so novel, interesting, and enjoyable. And the highly energized, excited state of grade 5 piti makes potential distractions, such as altered body perception, illumination, and inner sound, even more potent. Competing intentions to attend to these phenomena repeatedly succeed in disrupting the consensus to attend exclusively to the breath. The excitement can also produce a powerful, restless urge to get up and share your experience with someone. It's also common to mistake the intense joy, inner light, and transformed perception of the body for something more exalted. The ebullient satisfaction of meditative joy may make you think, "I've arrived. What more could I want? This is it." Remember, joy affects not only how we feel in response to experiences, but also how we perceive and interpret them. Enjoy these positive qualities, but don't be misled by them. To deal with these distractions, urges, and misperceptions, recognize them for what they are, and just let them come, let them be, and let them go. Yes, you'll likely give in a few times at first, but as soon as the euphoria subsides, return to the practice with a firm resolve to ignore whatever arises. On the positive side, these disruptions let you practice regaining piti after you've lost it. An adept meditator at this stage can usually overcome these problems quickly and easily, and stay with the piti longer. However, the better you are at ignoring these potential disruptions, and the longer you succeed in sustaining grade 5 piti, the more intense the mental energy associated with joy becomes. This is because ignoring them further unifies the mind, making even more energy available. In turn, the increased energy makes the joy more buzzy and frenetic until the very intensity of the experience disrupts the piti again. Your greatest challenge in this stage is that the mental energy keeps increasing until you can't even stay focused enough to sustain mental and physical pliancy. The solution is just to be resolute and persevere in your practice. When you falter, re-enter the state of pervasive piti and keep your attention on the breath while ignoring the energy and excitement. It's the same as when you pacified the discriminating mind and the senses. The conscious intention to let these things remain in awareness, combined with the firm resolve to ignore them with attention, allows the mind to unify and transforms how the mind system functions. So, practice at this stage is really quite simple. Achieve pity, sustain it for as long as possible, and start over when you lose it. Eventually, you can sustain pity long enough for its intensity to peak and begin subsiding. Subjectively, it seems like you just get used to the intensity of the pity, that it subsides because you've become familiar with it. At a deeper level, it's because the mind system continues to unify. The same energy that once caused disruption now gets channeled into stabilizing the entire mind system. Once that happens, you can usually sustain a state of tranquil piti for the rest of the sit. With continued practice, you won't just get used to the initial energy and excitement, but the peak will grow less intense as well. It eventually becomes more of a bump, easy to traverse, followed by even stronger tranquility. Sometimes, especially in retreats, the bump disappears completely, and you slide right into tranquility and equanimity. What subsides first is the bliss of physical pliancy, the deliciously pleasurable physical sensation that pervades the body. It doesn't disappear completely, but it recedes into the background. However, the stable, comfortable, and pain-free condition of physical pliancy doesn't change. Next, the coarseness of the bliss of mental pliancy, its energetic, agitated quality, disappears, replaced by a serene happiness and tranquility. It's a lot like a post-orgasmic state. Physical pleasure has subsided, but a residue remains, and the intensity and excitement have also faded, but the joy and happiness persist. Useful practices for calming piti and maturing joy. By repeatedly focusing your attention on the breath and ignoring everything else, you can sustain piti, allowing joy to mature as the mind grows unified. However, if you've been practicing the luminous jhanas, you can speed up your progress by regularly moving through the higher luminous jhanas. The second jhana has the same quality of mental excitement and intensity as a completed stage 8 and early stage 9, but with the greater stability of absorption. Moving to the third jhana is just like successfully achieving the goal of stage 9. The intensity and agitation are gone, and there is only a serene pleasure and happiness. The fourth luminous jhana is like stage 10, with only tranquility and equanimity. Therefore, these jhanas can help habituate you to the calm piti of the mature form of joy. Other practices that can help calm piti have the added benefit of being conducive to insight. These include the meditation on dependent arising and finding the still point and realizing the witness. Another extremely powerful practice for calming piti and generating insight is meditating on the mind. Meditating on the mind. Meditating on the mind itself involves bringing attention and awareness together in a completely open state. Essentially, you're fusing attention and awareness. To achieve this, you expand your scope of attention until it includes everything in your field of conscious awareness, both extrospective and introspective. This is similar to how you expanded your scope of attention to include the whole body in stage 6, except that you're expanding it to include much, much more than just bodily sensations. And, as with the whole body practice, the amount of conscious power required for attention to encompass so much is enormous. That means much of the excess mental energy made available through unification can get put to immediate use instead of just agitating the mind. Start either from the still point or from an exclusive focus on the breath with strong metacognitive awareness. Expand your scope of attention gradually at first. You're working against the natural tendency for attention to contract around a particular object, so each time you expand the scope a little more, rest for a while in that larger, more open space. Make sure that everything within that scope is perceived with equal clarity before moving ahead. Whether you start with the attention focused on the still point or the breath, awareness should be almost entirely metacognitive. When you expand the scope of attention until it includes everything in awareness, the entire field of conscious awareness is the focus of attention. The object of meditation is the mind itself, and the distinction between attention and awareness disappears. As you know from the practices you did in Stage 8, metacognitive awareness can include extrospective content. In other words, you can be metacognitively aware of external sensory information passing through the mind. Therefore, allow your mind to project both sensations and purely mental objects into consciousness. Hold a clear intention to allow things to come and go in peripheral awareness, but in a slow and gentle way rather than as a flood. Attention will still try to contract around specific objects, so practice catching that impulse as soon as each new thought or sensation arises, and immediately release attention before it can zoom in. You'll eventually have the sense that attention and awareness have merged and become indistinguishable. The holistic quality of awareness and the analytic precision of attention are both fully present. The mind has become a well-tuned and powerful instrument, capable of simultaneously observing individual objects and their relationship to the entire field of conscious awareness. This is an extremely clear perception that takes place within a vast, open mental space. As you observe the mind with great clarity, you start distinguishing between two fundamental states of consciousness. The first is where the mind is active. Specific sensations and mental objects are being projected into the field of conscious awareness by unconscious sub-minds. The other is a state of comparative rest, where no cognizable objects are present, and the space-like field of conscious awareness lies still and empty. Your objective is to investigate the nature of the mind by comparing the active and resting receptive states. The main purpose of this practice, for this stage, is to generate stable, consistent tranquility and equanimity. Yet it's also extremely effective at producing insight. Indeed, some adepts use it as their primary technique for investigating the mind. The description of the mind in a resting state may sound like the cessation event discussed in the seventh interlude. To be clear, they are not the same. This is not cessation, and consciousness does have content, just not a cognizable object. However, this investigation can give rise to the same insights as the cessation experience. Insight, emptiness, and the nature of mind. By observing the nature of mind in both its active and passive states, it eventually becomes clear that all objects of consciousness are constructs of the mind. All we've ever known is what the mind itself has produced. The true nature of these mind-made objects of consciousness is simply the nature of mind itself. You may have already grasped this intellectually, but you now experience it directly. True, there may have been some external stimulus that caused your unconscious sub-minds to project a particular object into consciousness, but all we can ever observe is the mental object, a product of the mind itself, not the source of the original stimulus. To put it another way, the thing in itself that stimulated the mind to produce the object can never be observed. The mind creates its own reality, made entirely of cognitive, emotional constructs produced in response to unknown and ultimately unknowable forces acting on the mind through the senses. Furthermore, the perceived appearance of these constructs has far more to do with the nature of the constructing mind than with the actual sources of sensory data. The one thing we can be sure of is that the true nature of that unknown source is quite different from anything the mind projects. This is what is referred to as the emptiness of all phenomena. The objects of consciousness arising and passing away in the mind are like waves rising and disappearing on the ocean surface. Just as the waves have no existence apart from the ocean, arising due to forces acting on the ocean, so, too, with the contents of consciousness and the mind. The ego self, that familiar notion of who and what we are, is just another one of those empty mental constructs. so are the egocentric thoughts, emotions, and intentions that arise in consciousness that reinforce belief in the ego self. When you realize your ego self is as empty as any other mental phenomenon, you may be tempted to relocate your sense of personal identity to the mind, or even consciousness itself. However, if you keep practicing this meditation on the mind, you will eventually realize that your perception of the mind at rest is as much a construct as anything else. That is, your subjective experience of watching the mind, and therefore the very idea of the mind as something self-existently real that can be watched, is no different from any other object created by the mind. The mind is as empty as the objects that arise within it. With this further insight, it's no longer possible to believe in your mind as the self. The insight experience triggering this last insight is often a cessation event, and, as with the cessation discussed in the seventh interlude, takes the form of a pure consciousness experience, or consciousness without an object. Our subjective experience of time stops. Consciousness has no object apart from this simple fact of consciousness itself. There is no sense of self in this experience, no witness, nothing. In the words of the Buddha, it is gone to suchness, or in the words of Nisargadatta, I am that. The more you engage in this practice, the deeper this insight will go, penetrating bit by bit, ever deeper into the most hidden recesses of your psyche. For this particular insight experience to occur, a specific constellation of causes and conditions must be present. In addition to stable attention, mindfulness, and joy, you require tranquility, equanimity, investigation, and diligence. The more complete and lasting your shamatha, the more strongly developed these factors are, and the more chance there is for insight to arise. Yet keep in mind, attachment to insight can itself be an impediment. It's far better to surrender all hopes and expectations. Just practice from a place of trust for the sake of whatever your meditation may bring. These insights will come in their own time. Awakening is an accident, but meditating on the mind is a practice that will make you accident-prone. It's especially important not to be deceived by mere intellectual understanding. You may think you got it just by listening to this description. However, many philosophers and scientists have understood this truth intellectually, but it hasn't transformed them. We haven't gotten it until this insight completely transforms the way we perceive the world, especially during challenging times, like when we're in an argument with our boss or partner, in a traffic jam, or when our house burns down. The arising of tranquility and equanimity. When the intensity of piti starts to subside, the mind's energy level doesn't drop. The mind actually has more energy than before, but it's being channeled differently, so the joy is accompanied by a sense of tranquility. The very energy that initially made your meditation so unstable is, in fact, the source of your increased stability. Flowing water provides a helpful analogy. Compare the wide, tranquil, glass-like smoothness of the Ganges to a narrow, roaring mountain stream. Even though the total kinetic energy of the Ganges is far greater, the narrow stream appears more powerful. This is because the constricted, cluttered stream bed produces a disordered, turbulent flow, whereas the Ganges has an orderly, smooth flow through a broad and unobstructed channel. The greater energy of the Ganges has carved a larger channel for itself, clearing obstructions and making the flow of energy far more organized. Before shamatha, the mind is like a wild but powerful mountain stream. There's a state of joy, but the accompanying energy is exuberant and turbulent, which is what gave the bliss of mental pliancy its coarseness. But just as with a river, the turbulent energy of piti eventually opens the inner channels, and the energy flow becomes tranquil and serene. Serenity and tranquility are quite blissful, and as they increase, so does the bliss. When the excitement of piti subsides, and there's enough tranquility, equanimity naturally arises. Equanimity is non-reactivity to pleasure and pain. Joyful tranquility produces equanimity simply because the pleasure and happiness generated within are so fulfilling that you already feel completely satisfied. Likewise, remember that joy not only causes a positive shift in affect, but also changes our perceptions in ways that maximize satisfaction. For both these reasons, we become much less reactive to pleasant and unpleasant events, since there's no need to pursue or avoid anything. In other words, equanimity arises because you're already happy and satisfied. Acting at a deeper level, equanimity also eliminates the tendency to see ourselves and our needs as more important than those of others. Conclusion. You have mastered stage 9, when you consistently achieve stable attention and mindfulness, accompanied by joy and tranquility. Equanimity is also present and grows much stronger in the 10th and final stage. Together, these 5 factors constitute the state of shamatha. However, when you get off the cushion, these qualities all rapidly fade. You're ready now to begin the work of stage 10. Experiencing the mental formations of meditative joy and pleasure, happiness, while breathing in, he trains himself. Experiencing the mental formations of meditative joy and pleasure, happiness, while breathing out, he trains himself. Calming these mental formations while breathing in, he trains himself. Calming these mental formations while breathing out, he trains himself. Anapanasati Sutta. Stage 10. Tranquility and Equanimity. 10. The goal of Stage 10 is for the qualities of shamatha to persist after you rise from the cushion. Just continuing to practice regularly will cause the profound joy and happiness, tranquility and equanimity you experience in meditation to persist between meditation sessions. Practice goals for Stage 10. All 5 factors of shamatha are present in Stage 10. Each time you sit, you quickly enter a state where attention is stable, mindfulness is powerful, and the unified mind rests in a state of joy, accompanied by tranquility and equanimity. However, these quickly fade when you rise from the cushion. Your goal for this stage is to reach a point where shamatha persists between sittings, permeating your everyday life. This is the one real change left in the perfection of shamatha. Then shamatha becomes the normal condition for the adept mediator. The distinction between meditation and non-meditation largely disappears. As with the goals for the other adept stages, all you have to do is keep practicing, and shamatha will last longer and longer each time after you get up. You don't need to do anything new. However, you can practice mindfulness in daily life in a way that prevents shamatha from eroding as quickly. The role of equanimity. When you rise from meditation, you soon become engaged with external stimuli that the mind must respond to. Many of the mind's responses involve habitual reactions in the form of desire and aversion. Equanimity means non-reactivity, so as long as equanimity is strong enough, these mental habits will have little effect. However, attention must move in response to events in daily life much faster than it does in response to intentions in meditation. Furthermore, the variety of situations needing to be dealt with is far greater. Before long, equanimity is overwhelmed, and reactivity in the form of desire and aversion erodes unification of the mind. Since unification is the pillar on which shamatha rests, we soon find ourselves back in a normal state of mind. You may not have analyzed the process by which this occurs, but by the time you reach stage 10, you'll have experienced this many times. Equanimity is what ultimately prolongs shamatha outside meditation. Equanimity will grow stronger through stage 10, and as it does, shamatha will last longer after your sits end. Clearly, the more equanimity you have in meditation, the more you will have afterward as well. But you can also support and sustain that post-meditation equanimity by practicing mindfulness in daily life. Sustaining shamatha with joy, equanimity, and mindfulness. Although shamatha tends to fade after we get up, a state of joy tends to linger. Joy produces pleasure and happiness, and this positive effect, coming entirely from within, makes us less likely to react to external events with desire or aversion. That is, post-meditative joy can also help sustain equanimity. It goes in the other direction, too. Equanimity keeps desire and aversion from eroding unification of mind, which in turn supports and sustains the continuation of joy in everyday life. The two reinforce each other. Therefore, the key to extending shamatha in everyday life is to support joy and reinforce equanimity through mindfulness. Practicing mindfulness off the cushion means being aware whenever desire or aversion arise. When that happens, recognize what's going on. Some unconscious subminds are in conflict with what is, craving for something to be different. Don't resist, reject, or suppress the craving. Instead, ignore it. Then intentionally direct your attention to that inner pleasure and happiness that has nothing to do with what's occurring externally. Likewise, purposely intend to notice the positive aspects of whatever you perceive. As long as all the other subminds don't react to the event or to the feelings of desire and aversion arising in reaction to it, then the conflicted subminds will come back into line. When we mindfully observe and accept both the situation and our mind's reaction to it, equanimously and without judgment, then the mind will remain unified. As equanimity grows stronger in meditation, the mind outside of meditation grows less prone to grasping, and we feel less compelled to pursue pleasant experiences. You'll also enjoy pleasant experiences more fully because you're no longer attached to them, hoping they continue. Similarly, you'll be less and less repelled by unpleasant experiences, facing them with growing equanimity. Practice sustaining joy and equanimity by remaining mindful until some vestige of shamatha persists when you next sit down to meditate. By the time you settle on the cushion, the body will already be still and comfortable, and physical pliancy will soon follow. Since joy, tranquility, and equanimity have not yet fully faded, they quickly return to full strength. Practices for Stage 10. Stage 10 is ideal for doing any type of insight practice. You can do close following, the meditation on arising and passing away, choiceless attention, the meditation on dependent arising, realizing the witness, or anything else. Your mind is also in a perfect state to practice the luminous jhanas as well. Through these practices, insight accumulates and matures, and the experience of awakening quickly follows. Conclusion. You have mastered stage 10 and achieved the fourth and final milestone, when shamatha typically persists from one regular meditation session to the next. Strong desires are noticeably weaker. Negative mental reactions rarely occur, and anger and ill will virtually disappear. Others may find you generally happy and easily pleased, relaxed, agreeable, unaggressive, and peaceful. You will be relatively immune to disturbing events, and physical pain won't particularly bother you. On mastering stage 10, the mind is described as unsurpassable. It's an ideal instrument for achieving and deepening profound insight into the true nature of reality and a liberation that is not subject to passing away. The following sequence from the Buddha describes the process by which mastery is achieved. Experiencing the mind while breathing in, he trains himself. Experiencing the mind while breathing out, he trains himself. making the mind tranquil and fresh while breathing in. He trains himself. Making the mind tranquil and fresh while breathing out, he trains himself. Concentrating the mind while breathing in, he trains himself. Concentrating the mind while breathing out, he trains himself. Releasing the mind while breathing in, he trains himself. Releasing the mind while breathing out, he trains himself. Anapanasati Sutta. Final thoughts. The goal beyond stage 10 is to use the power of shamatha for the continued awakening of insight and to progress to the highest level of complete awakening. The practice in this book is shamatha vipassana, but we have focused mostly on the stages of shamatha. The reason was purely practical, to prepare the mind as quickly as possible for the ultimate goal of insight and awakening. With every stage of shamatha you pass through, the possibility of insight grows more likely and increases quite dramatically with each stage from 7 on. Many of the techniques described in the later stages are intended to generate insight experiences. Indeed, few meditators master stage 10 without having significant insight. Many will have reached at least the first level of awakening. Much more could be said about insight and awakening than can fit into this book, so it must wait for another time. While unlikely, it's possible for someone to master shamatha without achieving insight or awakening. Therefore, it's worth discussing why this might happen, as well as some of the limitations of shamatha, to help protect you from this potential problem. Shamatha and vipassana. The limitations of shamatha. Persistent shamatha between meditation sessions is a truly wonderful accomplishment and something to celebrate. Yet never lose sight of the fact that shamatha and vipassana must work together. They are like two wings of a bird. You need both to arrive at your ultimate destination. Too often, however, practitioners forget this relationship and emphasize either shamatha or vipassana. For listeners of this book, the danger is placing all the emphasis on shamatha, seeing this super-refined state of mind as the goal, rather than the ideal state for achieving insight and full awakening. Always remember that even though shamatha is extraordinary, it's still a conditioned mental state. When those causes and conditions cease, shamatha dissolves. Even though shamatha persists for longer after stage 10, it still starts fading, gradually but continuously, from the moment you get off the cushion. Life events chip away at this refined state of consciousness, and unconscious sub-minds diverge from consensus, creating inner conflict. Other sub-minds in turn react with aversion, and unification starts unraveling. When enough of your buttons get pushed at once, shamatha will fail. Even if you just spent 3 hours in deep jhana, if something significant enough happens, shamatha disappears altogether. In an ideal environment, we would always be able to meditate again and return to a state of high unification before shamatha fades. We might succeed in avoiding the kind of events that disunify the mind for a long time, perhaps remaining in a continuous state of shamatha for months. But very few listeners of this book are likely to find themselves in such ideal conditions. Even those so fortunate can never be sure how long those conditions will last. And everyone eventually finds him or herself unable to sustain a regular practice due to sickness, old age, or failing mental faculties. That's why shamatha isn't the final goal of the spiritual path. Instead, consider it a rare and precious opportunity to achieve the true goal, insight and awakening. The unsurpassable mind of shamatha gives you immediate access to the deepest form of jhana, to every kind of insight practice, and allows you to practice mindfulness in daily life with incomparable effectiveness. In other words, it creates the ideal conditions for liberating insight into the true nature of reality and an awakening that isn't subject to passing away. The unification of mind in shamatha is temporary and conditioned. However, the unification around insight is far more profound, and it's permanent. When temporary unification around a shared intention fades, each sub-mind operates as a separate entity, constrained by and at the mercy of the mind system as a whole. Therefore, individual sub-minds strive to preserve their autonomy and, as much as possible, direct the resources of the mind system toward their individual goals. Yet after insight, the various sub-minds become unified around a shared insight into impermanence, emptiness, suffering, no-self, and interconnectedness. From this flow a corresponding set of shared values, harmlessness, compassion, and loving-kindness. Now, each sub-mind operates as an independent part of a much greater whole, working for the good of that whole. This allows each sub-mind to do its job effectively, without running into fundamental conflicts with other sub-minds. When enough of the mind system has undergone this transformation, we're able to function as an individual person while simultaneously perceiving ourselves as part of an indivisible and inconceivably greater whole. T.S. Eliot beautifully described the nature of this transformation. "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." T.S. Eliot, Four Quartets, Little Gidding. The illusion of separate selfhood, with all its attendant suffering, is gone. We can be fully present as persons, here and now, realizing that this personhood is just an ever-changing, selfless construct arbitrarily imposed on an interconnected whole. Here is merely another construct imposed on infinite space, and now is a similar construct imposed on eternity. This concludes The Mind Illuminated by Chula Dasa, John Yates, Ph.D., and Matthew Immergut, Ph.D., with Jeremy Graves. Narrated by Sean Renette. Copyright 2015 by John Charles Yates. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Touchstone, a division of Simon & Schuster, Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2017 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks, and to take advantage